You don't know if it's clapworthy yet. I get a lot of mileage out of that line. So I rushed, last time was such a rush, and I'm going to send him over to his friends, Doug and Elise over there. Go on, go say hi. So Ripley's my partner. He's a trauma canine that through Free, we're also missionaries part-time through Free International, looking for missing exploited kids, and that's how we got Rip. And he also goes to my sessions with me as a therapist. So currently, last 6 years, I've been working as a therapist. I work for Rockbridge, which I didn't mention last time, which is an offshoot of Teen Challenge. So Teen Challenge is our governing body, but we don't advertise it because we don't do ChemDep. It's like a straight-up mental health clinic. We're all believers, but we see anybody. So, but, you know, I do get a lot of pastors, which are my favorite. I love working with pastors. And law enforcement is my other favorite. So I can swear like a sailor, and I can quote verses. It just depends on which hat I'm wearing in the moment. But speaking of verses, so we're going to go really fast because I ran out of time last time. Genesis 2:18, God created us for relationships, right, from the very beginning. Then the Lord God said, it's not good for man to be alone. I'll make him a helper. Hebrews 10:25, not abandoning our own meeting together, as is the habit of some people, but encouraging one another all the more. Ecclesiastes, two are better than one, da-da-da-da-da-da. It's throughout Scripture. What is the church created for?
Relationships.
Yeah, community. Relationships, right? We can't do this alone. God created us for relationships. If you're isolated, you're hurting bad. In fact, we use it to torture people. So say you're taken by some other government and they wanted to break you. What do?
Isolate
you. What's the worst punishment in the federal prison system?
Isolation.
Supermax, 23 hours a day on your own. So don't do that to yourself. God designed our brains for relationship. So we have this thing called dopamine. It's a reward chemical. It's really good stuff, right? It makes you feel really good. When you fall in love with somebody, you are high on drugs for 18 months or so, right? When I fell in love with my wonderful wife, Amy, my end of my senior year was just in time. Man, it was a close call for me. But right before I graduated North Central, and I would sit for hours on the phone and talk, and I wanted to. I hate talking on the phone, right? But dopamine's like, yeah, just right? So that's really good stuff. And so, but you know what? When it wears off, you can still have passion because that passion builds commitment. It builds that commitment, that base that you can build on. When we're not as high on drugs, commitment builds future passion. And that's a quote from Jarvis Glanzer. Look, give him credit. Watermark. Good guy. Good pastor.
He's been preaching that since
really? Yeah, tell him I quoted him. So maybe I can pay less tithe this week. So the other chemical we want to talk about is oxytocin. That's a neurotransmitter brain that helps with social bonding. You get it from giving childbirth, breastfeeding, sex, hugging, petting dogs. Or maybe cats? I don't know. I'm not sure about the cats thing, but yeah. Dogs for sure. But it's this chemical in our brain that bonds us. God designed our brains to bond to each other. Isn't that cool? Mm-hmm. It's his idea. So it's good stuff. My clicker's isn't working. Okay. I have so many people come to me and talk about, I don't have any friends. I can't figure this out. And one of my favorite books I found was C.S. Lewis, The Four Loves. It's a short little book, but Lewis is so good, you know. And I like it because I have to think really hard to follow it, you know. But it's really a good book. And he brought so much wisdom to this by breaking it down relationships into four categories. And the first is affection. We can have affection for many people. That's that kindness, I'm happy to see you. You know, there's some people here I see once a year maybe. I have affection, it's great to see you, right? That's not necessarily a friendship, because you need time for a friendship, but I can have affection for others. You can have affection for pets, right? It's this good thing we can do. So that's the first level of relationship. The second is friendship. Now, here's what I like about Lewis. He describes friendship as facing the same direction, same interests, same values, same place in life, same challenges, right? There's those people that you're doing life with. You can only have so many good friendships because it takes time. Mm-hmm. We have limited time. When I guess it'll come up in relationships. So my wife and I, we have two bio daughters in their 30s now. And our son, who's in his mid-20s, we adopted when he was 12 from South India. And I didn't know where he's going with that. But anyway, they'll come up. So that was going to tie to this point really well. It's going to be really life-changing. Sorry about that. But
facing the same direction.
Facing the same direction. Oh, yeah. So I guess we've... Oh, I know. Thank you. Man, you're good. I had to jettison almost all my friendships to survive raising our adopted son who went through hell before he got to us. And it's like the movie Lion, if you know it. It's that, his story. And he lives in horrible situations for years after mom fell asleep on a train, woke up, and his mom and brother and sister were gone when he was 4. So that's all I did, that and work. And my wife. So I lost my friendships. Not lost, but I couldn't engage with them because there's no time. But now I do, because now there's more time. He's great. He's functioning well. He's doing awesome. He's doing really well, in fact. So friendships. You're facing the same, but only so many. And they change over time. Mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien were fast friends. They had the club, you know, the Inklings. Yep. They meet at the pub every week, and they share these very erudite kind of stories they're writing, and talk about myth, and there's other people in this group too, these very smart Oxford types. They meet every week, this fast friendship. They share their stories before they published and critique each other. J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis eventually kind of fell out a little bit. They didn't hate each other, but Lewis ended up going to Cambridge, and they kind of had different thoughts on some things. So their friendship was the most important thing ever. In fact, it was Tolkien that helped lead Lewis to faith, right? Addison's Walk. It's a great story if you read it. But it was Tolkien, who was a very devout Catholic, influence in Lewis's life, who was an atheist and eventually a deist and then eventually a Christian. So that was the most important friendship, but eventually it wasn't, right? So you'll have different seasons. Like I had friends in college that were fast friends. I don't see them much anymore. But that's okay, I still like them. And we talk to you, oh, you pick up where you left off. But you shouldn't expect to have a ton of close friendships because it takes too much time. And they change over time, right? So if you want to find friends, find people that are interested and have the same values as you. And one of the best ways to do that is to serve. Because when we serve, we're actually popping dopamine. God created our brains for service, and we pop big dopamine when we're serving others without expectations of anything in return. And when you serve together, super powerful. Like missions trips, everybody comes back like, we're best friends forever, right? It's that, because you're seeing new things and you're serving together, and it's that dopamine popping at the same time where the same thing pulls people together. And tell couples to do that aren't doing well. Go serve together. Right. Eros, that's romantic love. That's this way. It's not that way. It's this way. And you can tell the differences because you always play remember when. Remember when, yeah. Right? It's that. So love is wonderful. Committed marriages are beautiful, but that's Eros. And then the last one's charity. And that's the highest love. So that's God's love for us. And when we serve others without anything expecting in return, that's charity. That's the highest love, is that service to others. Mm-hmm. So if you want to figure out how to make relationships, read this. I read it. It was a go back to sleep book, actually, when I wasn't sleeping well. And I stayed up all night reading it. It got me. So it's on my bookshelf at work, and I point to it all the time. So communication. Now, the basis for relationships is communication, right, Ripley? Absolutely. So he's communicating with his tail and his attunement and all that good stuff. So how do we do it? So how many people were in the last session? Oh gosh, I'm sorry, because some of it's a repeat, but it's good to repeat, because some of you didn't hear it. Okay, so we all have mirroring neurons, and I'll go quick on this. When we're born, the only way we learn anything is by imitation, because God gave us mirroring neurons that compel us to imitate. Those mirroring neurons stay with us until we die. Right now, you and I are compelled to imitate each other. So when somebody's amped up and upset, we're compelled to imitate them. When somebody's calm, we're compelled to imitate them. When we can stay calm, we compel others to be calm. And if you want to test this out, just be observant, and you'll find when you're talking to somebody, you'll hold your glasses the same way. Or sit this way. It's that true, right? So if you look for it, you'll see it. So use your mirroring neurons. You got to listen. Nobody really listens to us, right? We live in, it's not our culture, it's just human nature. We're all self-centered. It's hard to listen well. If you can listen well, it's kind of magical. Of all my years in the Bureau, I only had one really good boss. I had some lousy bosses. We had great agents, but they promote people that want to be promoted and are willing to move to headquarters every 2 years. So we got some bad ones. But the one good one would listen well, and it was intoxicating. Betsy, she was great. We'd climb any mountain for her, and she listened, and it was really a great experience having that. So listen well. It's better to be interested than interesting. It's the same slide from before, last time. Zig Ziglar. We're all self-centered, like I said. It's much more important for me to be really interested in what's important to you than to tell you all the great things about me, because you're self-centered. So am I, right? We all are. Yep. So if I can focus on what's important to you, that's what pulls people into us. And people are fascinating, right? It's fun. It's really, people are interesting, right? Curiosity is a great thing. Be curious about people. God creates some really wild folks, right? And with lots of life experience. You got to have rapport before you have influence, right? Rapport is everything. I want to focus on what's important to you. And like I said last session, we all lead what we wear and who we are with what's important to us, right? Like, you know, our tats are great. Like, you know, that says a lot about me if you were able to read it. So I always start with tats if somebody has them. Cool tat, cool ink, where'd you get it? You know, I was drunk. Oh, wow, that's a story. So last one, hooks versus landmines. We all have those hooks, those things that are passionate for us. Find that and talk about it. If I can talk about something that's passionate for you, I'm in. And I can ask good questions about things I don't know anything about. You know, because I know, for example, that, ma'am, you are the world's biggest Green Bay Packer fan in the world. Like, you bleed green. That's all you can focus on. You know, I'll tell you a little secret about me. This is being recorded, but to edit this out, please. I don't know anything about sports and could care less. Like, I just don't. It's boring. Like, what? You know? But as a guy, I'm supposed to know, you know? So I know just enough about sports, and I changed the topic. Yeah. I called the bob and weave. I was at a barbershop once, and my wife was there. She said, I didn't know you know so much about sports. Just enough, right? Bob and weave, baby. So, but I can talk about the Green Bay Packers by asking really good open-ended questions. I won't say who's the coach. I'll say, who do you think should be coaching them? Or why the passion for this? I might find out, well, my dad, who's passed, watched it with me. I'm like, oh, right? Yeah. So you can ask good questions about, like, your big passion is 14th century Italian architecture. I don't know anything about that, but I can ask good questions about it. So, and you will step on people's landmines. Don't step on them twice. Yeah. And let me say this, too. If you're married to someone, still talk about their hooks.
Mm-hmm. Straight up.
Yeah. My wife loves gardening. It's her big passion, and she's very good at it. It's not my passion, but it's passionate to me because it's for her.
Right.
And so I ask her about it. I find gardens to go visit, and I build all the stones, like hardscaping, but engage with the other person's passions. Yeah. It's a respectful, loving thing to do. Okay. Here's a really good thing. So a lot of relationship information, I'm going to give you a name here, the Gottmans, G-O-T-T-M-A-N. How many people have read their stuff? Read their stuff. G-O-T-T-M-A-N. It'll be up on the last slide, too. So the Gottmans, he's more of a scientist. She's more of a therapist. They're a couple. And for years and years, they studied human relationships at the University of Washington. They set up a love lab, which isn't creepy. Sounds creepy, but it's not. So they bring couples in, and they wire them up. Heart rate, respiration, skin, like a polygraph. They measure your skin reactivity. They videotape it other than the bedrooms and bathrooms, of course. And then they do all these questionnaires before and after and follow-up. And John Gottman will say he can predict in a matter of minutes to within the 90% range, what marriage will make it and not. Wow. And I believe him. I do, because it's all this, they base it off all these data points. And so what they're doing is discovering God's truth, right? They're discovering these principles, the way God created us and how he created us to interact. And one of them is this. If you're in fight or flight, shut up. Seriously, I say it really harsh because it's so important. So let me explain fight or flight real quick again. For those that weren't here last session, here's my brain fist illustration from Dr. Dan Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, really good guy. Here's my brain. So we constantly have points of data flooding our brains, coming up and through. So we have our deep brain down here, and then we have our limbic system and kind of the deep brain, low brain, and deep brain's limbic system, hippocampus, a bunch of parts in there. That's our early warning system. That's where we store our traumas. That's where we store, like, don't touch a hot stove. Right? All that kind of stuff is in there. And then things flow through that to our cognitive, the squiggly part on top. Technically, it's called the squiggly part on top. And eventually the prefrontal cortex to make meaning of it. And that's where we think. When things come up and they hit our limbic system and our brain says danger, 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 it doesn't send the signal to the thinking anymore. We stop thinking. And it sends a signal down to the automatic side of the parasympathetic nervous system, and it does fight or flight. Adrenaline, cortisol, heart rate up, respiration up, muscles tighten, blood flow extremities to core, stomach shuts down. And one of the best indicators is heart rate. So I have couples that don't do well together. That's why they talk to me, right? Nobody comes like, we have a great marriage, we want to talk to you about it. No, right? That's not what I do. So one of the things I have people do is wear a heart rate monitor. Wear a Fitbit or Apple Watch and set it to 100. And if you're sitting still and your heart rate's 100, shut up. And I really mean it, because you're not thinking and you're going to say things that are going to hurt the other person. Right? And we have mirroring neurons. And once one person goes, the other person goes, right? So if you're with someone you love, or even if you don't love them, it's just the kind of thing to do. But if somebody is amping up and you can tell that, or if you're amping up and you can tell that, you use a calm I message. You never say, you're getting upset. That really helps a lot, doesn't it? Even if you're not as upset, you can say, I'm getting too upset. I don't want to be disrespectful. I'm going to take a quick break. Mm-hmm. And you have to take at least 20 minutes, and you have to think about something other than the thing that you're amping up over. Now, when somebody's amped up, do they say, oh, that's a great idea, take that break? No, we all want the last word. So I started this and I added this into it. So if I'm going to say that to someone, I'm going to say it while I'm moving. Yeah. You have to be moving, because that's the only way to, I need to take a break. I'm not leaving, I promise. I love you too much to fight with you. Yeah. Out. Mm-hmm. You can't do it when you're blocked in the doorway. I've had people with their spouses blocking the doorway. Mm-hmm. In the car, keep an Uber app on your phone. Pull over and say, I love you too much to fight. I'm going to take an Uber, you drive home. You got to think ahead of time, because when somebody's going, they're not thinking at all. And if you go, you're not thinking. That's when those really ugly fights happen. Mm-hmm. And I have a rule. I don't think it's up here, but never yell, ever. And therapists will disagree with me. I'm like, what? Don't yell. It should only be for health and safety. If you yell at your kids all the time and they're about to run in the street, it's just white noise. I never yelled at my son, because he was so much trauma, especially. I'm not a big yeller anyway, but I never did. But one time he was going to the street in front of a car, and it stopped him in his tracks. And then he didn't talk to me for a day. but he didn't get hit by the car. So don't yell at each other. And people say, well, that's the only way I'm heard. No. Mm-hmm. No. You're not heard at all when you're yelling, right? It's white noise. So please don't do that. You got to give some reassurances. And so you got to know your audience. So some people need to hear, I'm not leaving you as you take a break. I'm not abandoning you. Mm-hmm. I love you too. Just saying I'm taking a break, if you're afraid of the person abandoning you or you have that kind of history, too much. So tailor your calm I message to the person you're dealing with. But you have to avoid stonewalling. And stonewalling is one of the four horsemen that destroys a relationship, according to the Gottmans. And that is never coming back and talking about the important things. So say it's the budget thing. Because, hey, with couples, let's just say it's going to be physical intimacy, finances, raising kids, future vision. You know, there's these biggies. Division of labor, who does what, right? Those are the ones that bite everybody at some point. So if you need to talk about some finance things, and it's really important, if you always take a break and never talk about it, that kills it. So you have to promise a person, I'm not going to stonewall. Let's tomorrow night over dinner, like pick a time when it's calm. And if you have to take five times to talk about it because people keep amping up, that's okay because you're not doing anything good when you're amped up. And remember, a general wins or loses the battle by picking the time and place of it. Pick a time and place when you're peak. And here's a little hack. To be peak, do cardiovascular exercise beforehand because you get BDNF, GABA, serotonin, dopamine, endorphins, and endocannabinoids and increased blood flow. Calm and clarity. The general wins the battle by picking the time and place of the battle. So if you have to do something hard, go into it peak. Don't do a hard thing when you're tired. Elijah, right? He destroyed the prophets of Baal. The people of Israel turned back to God, and he ran away exhausted in fear, and God gave him a nap and some cake, right? Take a nap, have a cake, and then do the hard things. Don't fight over text, please. Never.
Yep.
I have a couple, if I had long hair, I'd be pulling it out. That's why I keep it short. Like, oh, you guys. You can't do any of the nonverbals on text. Don't. Like, the only thing on text should be, I love you, have a good day, what's for dinner, right? Yeah. You know, there's basketball practice after school. Nothing beyond that. You have to see each other. Don't do that to each other. Learn to negotiate and compromise, and please give up the need to be right.
Yeah.
You don't need the last word, and that's a humble thing, not taking the last word. Because we're all self-centered, and we all want the last word. The Gottmans say this, and this is why I like them so much. There are unsolvables in every marriage, every relationship. And this is friendships, this is child, parent, but there's unsolvables in every relationship. We're going to see some things different, and neither of us will change at some point, right? But that's fine, because you can learn to compromise around the unsolvables and then meet each other and agree on the things, which are the vast majority of things you can work together on and agree. But don't expect that the person, because we're all individual, even after years of marriage and love and commitment, we're still going to see some things differently and probably won't bend on them. Like, you will always love the Green Bay Packers. And you can marry somebody who's into the Vikings. Like, that will always be unsolvable for you. But it's going to be okay. You can compromise. And once again, don't yell, please. Oh, realize this. If somebody's drinking, and even like prescription medications affect us, like when we're doing hard things, we want to be fully cognizant, right? And the Gottmans will say, you know, you can go out for a glass of wine, but don't have two, right? Because they have the book called 8 Dates, where you go out and they have structured questions over the big 8 issues in a marriage. It's a great book. It's a really fun. I did some chapters with my wife, and after 33 years of marriage, I learned things about her. It's that good. So 8 Dates by the Gottmans. But if somebody's under the influence or they're overly tired, right, whatever's going on, or I have blood sugar dropping from not eating, make sure you're peak when you're doing hard things. Okay. Oh, boy. I'm sorry. There's so much overlap between the two. I didn't know it would be so many people. Okay. So how to deal with delusions. So in a relationship, a delusion is something that you disagree with someone that kind of unsolvable. Think about it as unsolvable. And like I said last session, it's either the NSA planted bugs in my head and they're using satellite technology to track me, which I don't think is true, by the way. And or it's like all cops are bastards, which people have told me, which I don't agree with, especially with my background and my love of law enforcement. And it can also be, I love the Green Bay Packers, you love the Vikings, and it's of huge issues to us, right? So when there's something like that that you're disagreement about, don't ever agree or disagree. with it. What you do is you go around it and ask how it's affecting the person. So how's it affecting you that the Vikings never win? How's that affecting you? Is that making it hard for you? And you all, I didn't offend you, did I? No, okay. But seriously, there in your relationships with people, there's going to be things that are between the two of you. Lewis and Tolkien would disagree about allegory. Like, you know, they're that smart. They had a big disagreement about the use of allegory, right? And that kind of hurt their relationship. So, but you can go around those things. So everybody in your relationship with, there's going to be some things there. Don't agree, don't disagree, don't try to punch through it. Go around it, how it's affecting them. Never act shocked, stay calm. Okay, forgiveness. Okay, I'll go a little deeper here now than last time on this one. If you're in relationship with someone, you're going to need to forgive them. Because I hate to tell you, you're fallen. And if we're redeemed, then we work through progressive sanctification, unlike some people believe, instantaneous sanctification, which I've never seen in my lifetime. But so we try to become more Christ-like over time. Mm-hmm. It's a process. But we will never get there this lifetime, which is really cool because that means it's continued meaning that we can strive towards. Yeah. But because of that, I'm going to hurt people around me. Yeah. I'm going to say really dumb stuff. I'm going to get emotional. I'm going to get upset, right? So, and they're going to do the same. So we have to forgive each other. And I have a good friend. They got divorced. And he's a really good guy, great heart. He made some mistakes early on just because of his family he came out of was a certain way. You know, he kind of went with what he was trained, and it wasn't working well. And then he's changed, and he asked for forgiveness and apologized. It was never given. It was never enough. Like, well, no, you really didn't ask. No, you really didn't. I'm like, poor guy. And it destroyed their relationship. Unforgiveness will destroy you personally, and it will also destroy your relationships. So you have to figure out a way to forgive. Recently, I've been thinking about it in these terms, which I think is more helpful, is the word repent. So the word repent, which I think a lot of people know, means to change your mind, change your direction. So for me to say, I'm sorry, it's good, but me to say, I'm sorry, well, they're seeing, or I'm talking about how I'm changing my mind. Like, I am so sorry I yelled at you. I'm going to work at not doing it. Here's what I'm doing. I went and figured out my anger. I'm working with somebody. I added these new things in. I want you to help me with this, right? That's pretty powerful. That's easy to forgive versus, oh, I'm sorry, as a toss away, right? I'm sorry is just words. It has to have the repentance component, and that makes it powerful. What else did I didn't do? It's a process to forgive. It's a choice too. So I didn't do this last time, but you probably, most of you in this room have heard Corrie Ten Boom's story about forgiveness. Mm-hmm. If you didn't, go on YouTube and watch her say it. Because yeah. The old YouTubes with her Dutch accent, it's so fun. Listening to her say it, it's like way better. Yeah. And then I'll tell you an inside story about Lauren Cunningham and Corrie Ten Boom. So Corrie Ten Boom, you know, the backstory. Does everybody know the backstory? Who doesn't? Okay, we'll get a quick thumbnail here. So she was raised in the Netherlands, and she never got married. She has this big, loving, faithful family, and they served the community around. Like, her and her sister would develop Sunday school for people with disabilities. Just a beautiful family doing such good work. She never got married, but she became trained as a watchmaker. Her dad was very exquisite watchmaker. She's the first woman in the Netherlands to be certified as a watchmaker. And they had this big shop next to their house where all their family lived, and they had people in and out, and great family. Well, who came to power about the time that she was in her 30s, I think, maybe 40s? The Nazis. And they're not Jewish, but they love Jewish people. And so they built a secret, the hiding place. This is a book, a hiding place between this, really well designed, between the store and the, or the shop in the house, and they hid Jews in there going to Freedom and resistance fighters. And Corey's job, part of it was to get enough food coupons to feed everybody, all these, which was really hard. And she had all these miraculous experiences, and they served so well, knowing at any moment their lives could be over for that service. Mm-hmm. Always the neighbor, some nosy neighbor, somebody dimed out to the Gestapo. They came and arrested them all. But the people that were hiding in the room never got caught, mm-hmm. right? They stayed there a long time, but they were able to get away. They never found the room. But her and her sister, her dad, they got taken to jails, basically. And her dad died right away. He's an older guy. Then her and her sister got sent to a concentration camp, Ravensbrück for women. And it was hell, right? And her sister were in there. But they served well there, smuggled the Bible in. We're ministering to the women in there. And then her sister ended up dying. And I have a quote on my wall from the book where it's her sister telling Corey, people go and share because people will believe you because of where we've been, basically, as she's dying. Okay. That's hard to get through, right? And then she did that. And she got released on a clerical error. Mm-hmm. A clerical error. And they killed all the women in the camp soon after she got released on a clerical error. She went home, recovered. And then she spent the rest of her life serving and trying to unify. They would use old Nazi facilities to bring people together, and she spoke all over. And she was speaking in Germany one time, and somebody came up to her at the end of the speech and said, "Do you remember me?" She did. It was the most sadistic guard that tortured her and her sister. And he asked for forgiveness. "Will you forgive me?" And she didn't go, "Okay," because she didn't want to. So she paused. It's like, but she made the conscious decision, "I forgive you," and offered that to him. It wasn't based on feelings. And I also say they didn't go for strudel afterwards. I don't think there was a relationship beyond that, but she made a conscious decision. And then she shared that story for the next probably 30 years all over the world. So hear her tell it herself. In fact, you guys know YWAM, Lauren Cunningham? We were just talking about him. Lauren went to Corey Ten Boom's 80th birthday. God's always talking to Lauren. He's passed now, but he's like, the guy was amazing. It was really fun to hang out with him for a bit. He said, "God's going to give you 10 more years, Corey, so I bought you a suitcase." And she made it to about 90. So Lauren was right. Wow. So she traveled the world her whole life, sharing the story of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a decision, not a feeling. And it doesn't mean you forget. There's people we forgive that will never be around again. And that's fine. That's fine. And I think another slide, it's easier to forgive when you believe God has perfect justice and mercy and he's going to sort it all out. I have so much in my head of so much dark stuff done to people. Like sometimes it overwhelms me. And I have to just lean into God, you're going to sort it out. When I was in the Bureau, there's people I couldn't catch that did really bad things. I didn't have the evidence to go beyond a reasonable doubt. I just couldn't. And I didn't break ethics, but boy, that hurt. But then it helped me just knowing, God, you're going to sort this one out. Mm-hmm. It's beyond me. Mm-hmm. So lean into that, because some people do things that I don't know how to forgive. I don't. It's a process. But focus on that God's going to sort it out with perfect justice and mercy someday. Yeah. It's not on us. Okay. I'm going to question, great.
Yeah, would you just go back and chat a little bit more on forgiving yourself? Because I think that's such a difficult thing for some of us sometimes.
Thank you. That's exactly right. So I'm going to use the story from Edith Eger for that one. I think stories are really powerful, right? They lock things in better than just a bullet point. So Edith Eger, I mentioned her briefly, but I'll tell a little more. She wrote a book called The Choice, so you should read The Choice about this. Eger is her last name. It's really hard to read the first part of the book because it's about the Holocaust, but it's a beautiful story. So she went she was in Hungary. She's in her teenage years, like 15, 16. She was training, she was trained gymnast. She was training for the Olympics, and she was a dancer. And she had a great family. Her and her mom, yeah, a little rough, but that's normal. And her, she had two sisters, but it was a beautiful family, loved her father. And they're Jewish and had this great life. He was a tailor. And then, you know, as the other story went, the Nazis came to power and they took all the Jewish people out of Hungary. And all three, all their family, except for one sister was out, was another part of the country playing violin somewhere, and she got hid through the war. She didn't get caught. But her and her sister, her mom and her dad, walked up to the selection line at Auschwitz off the cattle cars, so the four of them. And the person doing the selection day was Dr. Joseph Mengele. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it for a second. So and he's that pure evil, but super syrupy and sweet, which is even more evil. Yeah. Walked up to the line, and it was their turn. And right away, there's two places to go. One was the work side, one was death, instant death. And he pointed at her dad. He's an old guy, like, you know, go die. And then he looked at Edith and said, "Is this your mother or your sister?" And what did she say? "It's my mom." And he said, "Okay, to death." Wow. So, and then her and her sister went to the work side. And we're in hell for a year. You should, it's a story, she shouldn't be alive. Like, it's a miraculous story of survival. And there's so much to unpack there. But as it relates to this, she never forgave herself for probably 30 years. Yeah. She believed that she killed her mom. It was her fault. Mm. Not logical, but she felt that. And it affected her life deeply. Yeah. It was always there with her. She never, so much shame over it. She never told her kids she was in the Holocaust. They didn't know. Wow. She didn't tell anybody. Her and her husband... and she got, after she survived, she ended up marrying somebody she knew, and but they ended up getting divorced. They eventually came to America, and they got divorced when they were in America. She was a school teacher. And nothing was going right. She's just falling apart. And then she finally got to see a therapist, and she got to rage. Like, part of the things we need to do is rage at what needs to be raged against, yeah, and pass it through. Yeah. So she did. She raged about what happened to her and what shouldn't. And she finally got a point where she forgave herself. And that turned everything around. They got remarried, her and her husband. And then she said to her friend one day, "I would be, I would love to be a therapist and do this for people, but I'll be 50. And she's like, "You dummy, you'll be 50 anyway." So she became a therapist, and she's still out there on Facebook posting. I love her, Dr. Edith Egger, and beautiful YouTube. She does one from a TED Talk in San Diego about 3 years ago on courage. It's about 5 minutes long. I can't get through it without getting verklempt, you know. But she's such a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful woman. You have to forgive yourself. And here's what I do with people too, and myself, about forgiving ourselves. I've developed a cartoon image in my mind. And the creator of the universe that spoke everything to existence out of nothing, right? The creator of the universe that made everything. He said, "You're forgiven." And here I am in this, I don't, how do you compare creative universe to me? Like, microscopic, pointing my finger saying, "You're wrong, you're wrong." It's silly, it makes you laugh, right? It's silly. I'm this created, minuscule, precious to him, but minuscule to the creator of the universe. Can do anything you want. He said, "You're forgiven, the cross is big enough." Well, it's big enough. And who am I to tell the creator of the universe that he's wrong? Mm-hmm. Who am I to tell the creator of the universe he created something broken that shouldn't have been created this way? Mm-hmm. Who am I, right? It kind of puts things in perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's something you work on. And then, I don't know, here's the struggle. Like, we have to forgive ourselves, but sometimes we still have to live with the consequences. Right, and then you have to figure that out and work through that, because we can be forgiven, but maybe somebody's on probation for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. You can be forgiven, but maybe a person won't talk to you anymore. You know, but you're still forgiven. You're still forgiven. So they're deep questions, but thanks for bringing up, because you have to forgive yourself. It's a lot easier to forgive others than ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. And I love Edith Egger's story. It's worth reading. It's hard. Hard to read, but worth it. Okay. I got lots of her quotes in here. Like, half the shtick I have as a therapist comes from her. So So I'll give her credit. So in relationships, would you want to be married to you? Yeah. If not, then change some stuff. Would you want to be parented by you? Would you want to be therapized by you? Would you want to be pastored by you? Right? It's such a, that she's so brilliant and she has such life experience, Edith Eger. That's why I love her book and what she says. Like, if you want to get married, I have clients that want to get married. Well, become the person that you'd want to be married to, right? Destroyers of marriage is not feeling liked, loved, or respected. They're three separate things, like, love, and respect. Now, I work with a lot of couples in challenge, and I'll say, you don't have all three all the time. You still love each other, you just don't like each other very much. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, but remember, you still love each other.
Right.
So let's get back to liking and respecting. What do we need to do to get there? So they're three separate entities, but if you don't have them, and you're not working towards them, do you want to get up every day next to somebody that doesn't respect you? Or you don't respect them? Okay. Edith Eger, like, don't cover garlic with chocolate. As a therapist, I learned, name what's in the room. This is better. Don't cover garlic. If something's bad, talk about it. If you put chocolate over, it doesn't make the garlic taste any better. Right? So there's things you need to talk about. You can't cover them up. Don't pretend they're not there. Everybody knows it's there, right? Everybody knows, or at least your spouse. Like, we know each other so well, or your kids, like all these. When we're in relationships, we know people well. Don't cover up stuff. Don't syrupy cover it up with chocolate. Picture biting a big chunk of garlic. I love garlic, but it has to be roasted. But raw garlic with chocolate on it, right? It doesn't do any good. We're called in Christian marriages, but I say relationships too, we'll expand it out, to serve the other in love. So when I'm at my best as a husband, father, other relationships, I'm trying to outserve the other. A beautiful relationship is when two parties are trying to outserve the other. Your life is better because I'm in it today. That's the goal. And when we talked about submitting, I believe scripturally men have a higher bar than women do to submit to each other in marriage, as Christ did for the church. Well, Christ died for the church, right? So we are called to submit to each other, and we're called to serve each other, and it's really hard to do, and you're never going to do it every day, but if each couple has that orientation that they're trying to outserve the other, pretty cool, because you have a bad day, they have a better day, and vice versa, right? It's like that all the time, and you're working towards that. So if you can get close to that, isn't that the best?
Yeah.
That is the best. And it's not always easy. And
what did you say about, I'm sorry, I missed the part about men.
Yeah, so in Scripture, men are called to serve as their wives as Christ did for the church. And Christ died for the church. So I take that as, that's a high bar,
yeah.
Right? It's that submission to each other. We can debate that. Let's not do that. But
I just wanted to write the right thing.
No. But that's a debate out there theologically, but I know where I stand on it. I'd rather err on this side, yeah. Let's just say.
Yeah.
I hope I don't lose my credentials over that. I'm not sure. That's not one of the 16 fundamentals, so I think I'm okay. Okay. Your life does not depend on what you get from another person. You don't want to be codependent on someone. You have to be individually functional. Like, the more healthy you are as an individual, the better the marriage is. Two healthy individuals that are broken at times and we pick each other up, right? But if you're depending on this other person for everything, it doesn't work. They're still a broken human being who loves you and can serve you, but so codependency, to use the word. Don't try and be strong and heal yourself. Love is a four-letter word, another Edith Eger. Time. It just takes time. Here's some Gottman principles. The first one is the bluebird test. So if your spouse, if you're sitting around and your spouse, you're on the couch watching TV and your spouse is out the window and looks out the window and says, oh, look at that bird, because they love birds. You could care less about birds. It's not your thing. You'll eat chicken, but like looking at birds doesn't do it for you. And they say you have different options as a response. You can go, eh, right? Bad indicator, right? You could go and go, yeah, okay, it's a bird. Bad. You should be interested in what they're interested in. It's a key indicator of the strength of the relationship. You could care less about birds, but you're like, oh, that is a really cool color. Look at that. That's a really bright blue. Awesome. Thanks, hon. You're interested in what they're interested in. It's the kindness. You engage. You come to them. My wife's talking about gardening. Put down the TV or computer whatever, and focus on her because that's important to her. We should do that for each other. So are you able to focus on what the person that you're in love with, that you're in relationship with, focuses on, even though it's not your thing? It's a great test. PSO versus NSO. Positive sentiment override versus negative sentiment override. We need to default to the positive for the person in our life because we're all going to make mistakes. So I came up with a little illustration of this. Say you ask your spouse to pick up your clothes from the dry cleaner. Okay? You get home, they forgot.
Yep.
And you can have two options. So positive sentiment override option is, that's okay. They just forgot. No big deal. I'll get it tomorrow. How was your day? Right? They didn't do it on purpose. It's just, I forget stuff, right? Negative sentiment override is you did that on purpose. And this is in your head and verbally, but in your head, they did it on purpose. They could care less about me. I know it. Yeah, they didn't even think about me all day. Da da da. Right? Same event, same people, completely different interpretations. So if you're not able to default to the positive for the other, that's spooky in a relationship. Okay. Just a little bit about physical intimacy. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, because it's a big deal. Okay, so here's what works well. And I graduated North Central. I spent a lot of time talking about things I'd never think I'd talk about. Let's just say that in therapy. So each partner in a marriage needs to be able to decline physical intimacy and not have it be a big deal. Because you want to say, oh, just not, but gently, like, never again, you... No, not that. It's like, I'm just not today, or I'm not feeling up to. Okay. And the other person should say, that's fine. Because you never want to pressure, right? Mm-hmm. Pressure is a libido killer, yeah. Right? And if both parties get to the point where they can trust each other that there's no pressure, then you talk about it more and you have it more, right? There's more freedom in that once you take the pressure out of it. It's really important. be gentle about it. What's the other rule here? It's good maybe to understand each other's expectations because I'm shocked if people are married at the different expectations in this particular area. And there needs to be some movement and clear understanding of what that is. And it has to be compromise always in this area. And a really good phrase is this, I love, is foreplay happens throughout the day. Mm-hmm. Foreplay is having coffee ready when your spouse wakes up. Mm-hmm. Foreplay is picking up the dry cleaning and not forgetting. Mm-hmm. So it's how we live together is what the romance is. It's not particular things you do right before the thing that you do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So love each other well, and it leads to really good things in all areas of your marriage. Okay. Developing a shared vision for the future is key. You got to have a shared vision for the future because we all need meaning, right? We talk a lot about meaning, and if you have a shared meaning going towards the future, covers a multitude of sins and offenses, right? That shared meaning for the future is so important for us. Develop that. Here's the seven principles of Gottman's What Builds a Marriage. You can take a picture of that if you want. Okay, I'm not going to read through them all. I have a okay. I have a copy of the things up here. You can take a picture of it afterwards. I brought some sheets. How's that? Here's the thing: the four horsemen, criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. You will all do it at some point. Just don't do it all the time, right? And ask forgiveness when you do it. Okay, here's some exercises. These are kind of fun. They are. So I want people to read the book together. There's a couple of seven principles for making marriage work. That's the Gottman's kind of main text. I want one party to underline, one party to highlight. And you can see what each of you thought was more important in the text. Nobody's taking me up on it yet. It's a brilliant idea. So I keep telling people to do that. It'd be really fun. Do this question. So I ask people in therapy, what is the one thing you could do to improve your marriage? Don't tell the other person. Do it for a week or two. And then we get back together, we ask, what did you notice? Right? And that's something like, they'll say they did things that they were trying to do. Right? And sometimes they'll pick up on it. Sometimes they're like, what? You know. But so you set yourselves up where you each do one thing to make your marriage better without telling the other, just keep doing it for the week or two, however long between. And then when you meet up, you try to see if the other person recognized what it was you picked that you're trying to do. Yeah. Oh, you do, but that shows the side we need some work there, right? A lot of times people step up with this, you know, but it's a good indicator that we need to keep working.
Can you repeat that question she asked?
Oh, what if they get disappointed if they don't do it? But this is a data point to work with. And then another one is, what are three ways your partner needs to feel loved? This is what you do together. So I have each party list out for the other. So I would write down, I would start with my wife, for my wife, and say, she needs to feel loved this way, this way, this way. And then we'll go, is that right? Oh. Yes, no, yes, no, okay. And then the same for the other person. So you're trying to get out there what people need. And I don't like the love languages so much. They're limiting, they're not really well researched, but the core of it is true. We're all created differently. We all have different life experiences. And we need to experience and be proven the love of the person we're with over and over throughout life in the way that speaks our language.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
When are things best and why? When have things been that they're best and why? Is a fun question to talk about. Like, when was things really rocking well for us? Yeah.
Our dinner.
Yes. I think having shared meals together at the table as a nightly ritual with a family is key.
It's very important.
Even in FBI, I got up early and worked so I could be home almost every night to have dinner with a family. That was sacred. And you're right, yeah. It's a sacred time.
It is.
I like to do an existential question, which sounds really fancy, but the way I do is this. It's the last 20 minutes of your life. You're looking back on your life. You know you're going to die here soon. What do you want to look back on? And that will either be the best 20 minutes of your life or the worst. So I do that myself because it's a really good checkup, right? And then you can do that as a relationship too, because relationships is a big part of that. The miracle question, it's if you woke up tomorrow and everything was perfect, what would it look like? And you can taper that, adjust that to your relationship. If you woke up tomorrow and your relationship was perfect, what would it look like? It's a good way to get at what you really want to have happen in your life. So there's lots of fun ways to talk about things. The Gottmans are full of questions in their books that you can talk about back and forth on all the big issues. So it's hard to know what to say, but if you open a chapter, say, let's work through finance, let's work through division of labor or whatever, there's a lot of good stuff there. If you're talking, you're probably winning. Unless you're yelling at each other and your heart rate's over 100, then stop talking. Okay, that's me. I paced this one a little better. This time. I have sheets up here of the Gottman stuff, Edith Egger. I got active listening skills. And I also have this sheet from some questions couples can do. But don't do this. What do I hate about this when I bring this out for couples? Look at it. There's happy couples living. their best life. They're young and happy and in love. Don't do that because people are struggling where they're talking to me. So I can't show them the picture, you know, because people get like, ugh, I'll never be that, right? Okay, what questions do you have? You guys are awesome. We got 4 minutes. Let's change some lives. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yep, been there, done that one. So the thing to do is this, is I've now picture myself, I picture parents of teens as gentle guardrails to keep them safe because they can't help themselves. Dr. Dan Siegel talks about, there's a video on YouTube from Dan Siegel about adolescent brain development. It's on YouTube, Dr. Dan, S-I-E-G-E-L, adolescent brain development. It's about 5 minutes long. It's a doodle where they draw the pictures while he talks, explains a lot. And then he has another concept in other places that from the age of about 12 to 13, teens switch from being kids to becoming young adults to developing. And then brain does this switch. One thing is they become a specialist instead of a generalist. Like, I'm passionate about sports or this or that or whatever. That's why youth group is important in missions trips, because you get them passionate on the right things. Second thing that happens is they lose the ability to understand consequences. So that's why they do such dumb stuff. And you should expect dumb stuff. An 8-year-old understands consequences way better than a 17-year-old. Wow. That's why actuaries don't let men, especially teen men, rent cars till they're 25. Right? They figure out. That's why people join the Marine Corps at 18. Hoorah! At 26, I would join the military. They go to the Air Force or Navy because they have better food, right? You get a prefrontal cortex kicking in, girls or young women, early 20s, men, mid-20s, they're going to do dumb stuff they're supposed to. And so if you can be calm within that and be a gentle guardrail, let them bump and grind, and you can do a calm eye message, but you can do firm ones too, like, I'm not going to be disrespected. I'm not saying you're just, I'm not saying you're just, I'm saying, I'm not going to be disrespected. I'm taking a break. So as calmer you can be, the better. And realize that part of this is natural. We all did it. God designed it this way, I think, so we can take risks and grow and join the Marines or go to Bible college or whatever, right? Does that help?
Yeah, he's actually talking about joining the military.
Yeah. Which can be a great option for a lot of folks. But the Navy and Air Force have better food. Yeah, 8 dates.
8 dates.
D-A-T-S. 8 dates by the Gottmans. It's awesome. I have it on my shelf. I always pull it out to people. It's a really fun book to work through.
We're working with a couple where the husband is a malignant narcissist. We're having a time. Any suggestions?
The question was, they're working with a couple whose the husband's a malignant narcissist. Same thing if you have borderline personality. Some people you can't be married to. God doesn't call us to be abused.
Amen.
Right? So, and there's a lot of theology and practical things we can talk about here. But I work with a lot of spouses of people with personality disorders. And the only reason they stay in that hellish environment every week is because they don't want their kids alone with the person. So one guy's been with me for 6 years. Because every week's a new horror story, because he doesn't want his kids alone with the person. And so he takes the hits for him. So some people are so broken or make such bad choices, you can't safely be around them. And that's the fact of the matter. And there's so much to do to figure that piece out. But I deal with a lot of people. We're not supposed to be abused. The kids aren't supposed to be abused. You got to protect the kids. That's the bottom line.